From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Have you purchased a cemetery plot, or do you have other plans for when you go? On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the changing design of cemeteries and the changing place of cemeteries in our culture. Also, actress Billy Whitelaw discusses her collaborative relationship with the late playwright Samuel Beckett. And we talk about her starring role in the film The Craze as the mother of twin gangsters. The Craze just came out on video. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg warns us that some languages are disappearing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House announced today that President Bush has extended a waiver of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which ties improvement in U.S.-Soviet trade to the Soviets' immigration policies. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The waiver was expected in light of the Bush administration's moves towards more economic cooperation with the Soviet Union. It basically allows the Soviet Union to remain eligible for export credit guarantee programs of the Commodity Credit Corporation of the Agriculture Department and the Export-Import Bank. In a statement, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the president made this decision in view of the fact that the Soviet government has substantially reduced barriers to immigration for Soviet citizens. The waiver paves the way for the Bush administration to grant the Soviet Union most favored nation trade status and to grant a Soviet request for $1.5 billion in grain credits. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The chief Soviet prosecutor has cleared Soviet troops of blame for most of the 14 deaths last January in the Lithuania military crackdown. His report instead accuses pro-independence nationalists in the killings. Prosecutor Nikolai Trubin's report suggests that a young woman who was run over by a tank and killed was intentionally pushed. The report also said that most Soviet troops were firing blanks and that the fatal gunshots came from unidentified Lithuanians. China marked the second anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown with heavy security after dark. Students at Beijing University jeered and threw bottles at police to protest the 1989 massacre of unarmed citizens. But the rest of the city was quiet, as Sarah Lubman reports from Beijing.
Authorities cordoned off Tiananmen Square and posted police at major intersections and overpasses throughout the capital. The government was out to discourage any show of dissent on the sensitive June 4 anniversary. Police armed with pistols patrolled the Western University District, where the 1989 pro-democracy movement first took root. Students at Beijing University briefly defied the tight security by hurling bottles at police from their dormitory windows just after midnight. But the students appeared cowed by the large numbers of undercover police circulating on campus and did not leave their dormitories as they did a year ago. The government censored Western news reports from Beijing by banning outgoing satellite feeds of American and Canadian television networks. For National Public Radio, this is Sarah Lubman in Beijing.
The United States today welcomed France's decision to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and said Paris's move would set a strong example for other countries. The French announcement that it would join the 1968 treaty as part of a global arms control initiative, which the U.S. says is compatible with the Mideast arms control package proposed by President Bush. On Wall Street, the Dow gained nearly 8 points to close at a record high of 30.35 today. This is NPR. The countdown clock at NASA for the Space Shuttle Columbia began ticking for the third time today. The space shuttle has been grounded for 2 weeks by a host of last-minute equipment troubles. NASA wants to send Columbia on its long-awaited biomedical research mission this Wednesday at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. The Columbia is the oldest shuttle in the fleet. For this launch, it's received new computer components and fuel temperature sensors and a new navigational device. A former member of Germany's Red Army faction has been sentenced to 12 years in prison. From Berlin, Barbara Howard filed this report.
40-year-old Suzanne Albrecht was found guilty in the murder of a Frankfurt banker in 1977 and of preparing a failed attack on NATO commander Alexander Haig in 1979. The 12-year sentence is considered lenient in exchange for Albrecht's cooperation. That cooperation, according to the prosecution, has helped answer questions about the structure of the Red Army faction. Albrecht was one of 10 former RAF guerrillas arrested last year in East Germany, where they had been granted asylum and given new identities. The Red Army faction had been active in the 1970s and early 80s, kidnapping and killing West German politicians and businessmen. It had been dormant for a few years, but was reactivated 2 months ago when it killed industrialist Detlev Rohwedder in Dusseldorf. For National Public Radio, I'm Barbara Howard in Berlin.
The White House says that South Korean President No Tae-woo has accepted President Bush's invitation to pay a state visit to Washington on July 2nd. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the two leaders will discuss bilateral relations and security on the Korean Peninsula. No's government has been in crisis over the last 2 months with student and anti-government protests. No has changed his prime minister and 5 cabinet members in an effort to stop unrest, but critics want his own resignation. No has led South Korea since 1988. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cemeteries offer what we like to describe as a final resting place. The new book, Silent Cities, shows what the cities of the dead have to tell us about the cities of the living. My guests are the co-authors. Kenneth Jackson is the author of a previous book about the suburbanization of America. He's a professor of history and urban planning at Columbia University. Camilo Jose Vergara is a photographer who spent the past decade documenting urban devastation in America's slums. Jackson told me what interested him about cemeteries.
Well, first of all, Terry, I would say that it's quite simply the world can be divided into two sorts of people, those who like cemeteries and who are fascinated by them and who like to walk around on them, and those people who are delighted if they never set foot in another one.
See, I thought you were going to say it was divided between the living and the dead.
That's another cut. But there really are it's really quite a large number of people who find cemeteries to be fascinating. I think partly because they really force us to come to terms with our own mortality. When we're in a cemetery, it puts your mind on a different level. And the other thing is there's so much to learn and enjoy in cemeteries. They're places of beauty often. They're places where there are thousands of stories that you can sort of piece together as you look at the grave markers. It's a special kind of a place, and I think many people enjoy it.
Camilo, as a photographer, what did you want to do in documenting cemeteries, and why did you want to document them?
Well, that was a very interesting question to me, because I started from a very different point of view. That is, cemeteries were places where I had to go around. They were right in the middle of the old cities, and they were long blocks with just one entrance, and sometimes there was no way out. And I have done 12 years, maybe longer, of photographing of urban poverty. So I spend a lot of time in cities like Newark and Chicago and throughout the New York City area. And inevitably, as I was going around some of the poorest parts of those cities, I would find a very beautiful cemetery. And the contrast could not be stronger. And then, of course, that attracted my interest. First of all, was the tremendous contrast between the affluence of the dead and the poverty of the living, which is was so obvious.
Can you say that the first cemetery in the modern style in the United States is in New Haven? It was established in 1796, the Grove Street Cemetery. What makes this, in your mind, the first modern cemetery?
Well, because attitudes toward the deaths, at least the removal of the remains of the dead, have changed quite a bit over the centuries, both in this country and around the world. Before Grove Street was established in New Haven in the last part of the 18th century, the typical burial spot was outside a church. Now, the idea being that, you know, closer to the church you could be, the closer to heaven or closer to God. The problem was that over time, the churches were often located in the middle of the urban community, because that's where their parishioners were, and space became more crowded. What Grove Street represented, and Grove Street itself is not, you only see the beginnings of the new form of elite cemetery there. It was a little bit removed from the bustling city. It was more spacious. It won't seem spacious to the visitor today, but it was more spacious at the time. And it began to reorient thinking toward the cemetery as a place that might be beautiful. And these kinds of places were so successful and so beautiful that they really represent the first public recreational open park space really in this country.
What do you think it says about our beliefs about death that we've tried to create cemeteries that were beautiful with lots of trees and grass, not to mention monuments, open space?
Well, what it says is, and it was seen at the time as such, it was a sort of a negation of the finality of death. And it was the belief that through nature and through the nature coming alive with every season, with the flowers blooming and everything, that the bodies and the souls would be resurrected and that the families would be reunited, so that the cemetery, with all the verdancy, was a reflection of a belief in immortality, that death was just sleep, that it wasn't going to be something that was going to last forever, and that most important, I think, that the family was going to be reunited. And that was a very important belief. And not just the family, but also the different groups. This happened later, you know, the engineers, the Salvation Army, the nuns of the Sacred Heart, the firemen, and so on. So that that the end was not really an end.
One of the things you both wanted to do in your new book is to get a sense of what the differences have been in ethnic approaches to burial, the differences between Italians and Jews, between blacks and Hispanics. I'm curious, Camilo, in photographing headstones and tombstones, what are some of the striking differences you found between ethnic and racial groups in America?
Well, I found that the ethnic ethnic differences were very clear and very strong. So that you could, if you went to an Italian monument maker, or if you went to an Irish monument maker, or to an Irish section of a cemetery, you knew immediately because there were certain motifs that you would find over and over and over again. Same thing was true with German and Chinese and Japanese and so on. But I always had problems finding the difference between blacks and whites. I knew typically that if you went to a Newark cemetery and you look at people who had been buried there in the last 15 years, most likely those people would be black. Yet when I looked at their tombstones, I found that they were pretty much the same tombstones that whites of the same economic group would use.
There you see, Terry, so many of the important things. First of all, we see the class nature of American society. There are clear and very profound and striking differences within cemeteries between the mausoleums of the very, very rich, let's say, and the very simple graves of the very, very poor. So you see this. You see, as Camilo has expressed with his photographs in the picture, the differences between the various ethnic groups, that, you know, the Celtic crosses of the Irish look very different from the somber statues of the Germans, which look different from the uplifted figures of the Italian-Americans. There are these differences that you can also see. The dissolution of the family in the last century, it's very common if you go to an older cemetery and, let's say, a grave marker, let's say in the early part of the 20th century, and you'll see one kind of tall shaft that will have the family name on it. And then you'll see all scattered around of it, maybe a half a dozen, sometimes as many as 70 family members with little markers around, which is telling you something about the centrality of the family. Now, if you go to a cemetery, you'll most likely see a husband and a wife. Some cemeteries, in fact, won't even sell you more than two plots side by side. And now, with the rising divorce rate, we're not even going to see these kind of markers, you know, forever together. So really, you're picking up so many aspects of American life just by looking at the cemetery within it. But to come back to this issue of racism or segregation, which I think we touched on, until very recently, especially in the South, but really throughout the country, blacks and whites spent no more time together in death than they did in life. In fact, there's a very famous marker in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the grave marker of Thaddeus Stevens, who was a white congressman from Pennsylvania who was known for his leadership in radical Reconstruction after the Civil War. And he was buried in this old so-called Negro graveyard. And on Thaddeus Stevens' tomb, it says this, and he was white. It says, "I repose in this quiet and secluded spot, not from any natural preference for solitude, but finding other cemeteries limited as to race by charter rules. I have chosen that I might illustrate in my death the principles which I advocated through a long life, equality of man before his creator." But that was a very strong statement, just to be buried among black people, as if it made a huge difference. And I think that's part of this notion that we have, that the cemetery is such an accurate reflector of our society.
Well, while we're talking about how cemeteries reflect what happens in life in our society, I think it'd be interesting to look at Potter's Field in New York, which is a burial ground for the poor and for the for unclaimed bodies. You both went there, right?
Yes, yes.
And you need permission to go there. It's on a little island.
It was a very moving experience. It was early in the morning, and we waited in by a shabby deck. We waited for the boat, but we didn't know that we were also waiting for the trucks that were going to bring the boxes, you know, the pine boxes where the bodies of grown-ups and children have been put, and sometimes limbs, you know, from a hospital or something. It just they are placed there and they are put in the big hole that has been dug at Potter's Field. So we took the boat, and that was almost a recreation of a sort of a mythical experience. You know, it was crossing an expanse of water into the island of the dead. And you go to the island of the dead, and the island had been an old missile silo for the Nike missiles, and that's now abandoned. So there is this missiles that could cause tremendous death and destruction were sharing the island with the poorest of all New Yorkers.
There's about 750,000 people buried in Potter's Field in New York.
It's one of the most densely settled cemeteries because the land is reused over and over. As Camilo said, they had this big hole, and they buried people in mass graves of 148 people to a particular grave, all unmarked. And therefore, it really does have power. Although I think in some ways the sorrow and the tragedy of Potter's Fields is less profound to us in 1990 than it would have been to our fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers generations ago.
Yeah, because they saved so hard to have a plot in a good cemetery that they could get their whole family
into. Well, to
them
it was one of the worst things that you could imagine, to be buried in a potter's field. Mm-hmm. That somehow they saved 10 cents a week, you know, immigrant communities or in these rural communities, so that when death came that you could have a new dress and a nice coffin and be buried in a real grave and sort of go out in middle-class style at best. You know, now I think it's reflective of what we might call the death of the cemetery. I'm sure there are many people who wouldn't care whether they were buried in a potter's field or thrown out of an airplane or anything else. It seems it's somehow taken to be almost in irrelevance today, at least among many people, as to what happens to their bodies. And this kind of notion was almost inconceivable, I think, a century ago.
What are some of the other reasons you think that cemeteries are almost dying out themselves now?
Well, I think this is a real problem. It's hard to know all the reasons. I think just to draw the contrast, though, before we get into this discussion, I have a quotation from Judge Story in about 1831 when Mount Auburn Cemetery was dedicated. And his statement of what Mount Auburn was about then rings so strange in our own ears. Let me just read it to you. It says, "Dust as we are, the frail tenements which enclose our spirits but for a season are inexpressibly dear to us. We derive solace, nay pleasure, from the reflection that when the hour of separation comes, these earthly remains will still reclaim the tender regard of those whom we leave behind, that the spot where they shall lie will be remembered with a fond and soothing reverence, that our children will visit it in the midst of their sorrows, and our kindred in remote generations feel that a local inspiration hovers around it. They expected people to come visit their graves, and they thought that they would find inspiration there. We don't feel that very much anymore. We don't go to cemeteries. I gave a questionnaire out to class students of mine, both at UCLA and at Columbia University. And so many young people today have never even been to a cemetery, or maybe they've been once when their grandmother was buried. Very unlike the situation a generation or two or even 100 years ago, when visiting a cemetery was part of the ritual of growing up. You went to the cemetery on a regular basis, and that's where your parents took you. That was part of a weekend outing. We now, unlike the Chinese, for example, we have reverence for youth, and we have surgery, and we go on diets. We do everything to mask the fact that we're older. And then when the time of death does come, no longer do we sort of die in a sort of grandeur in our house at a deathbed and calling in our friends and family members to sort of give a last word and maybe hear a last piece of wisdom from this person who's now experienced life. Now we're not dead until we go into a hospital and get plugged into 14 kinds of machines, and it's done where no one can see it, and then someone just says that, well, they're gone now. So the experience of death has been removed from it. It's almost like this is too disgusting to talk about.
My guests are the co-authors of the new book, Silent Cities, The Evolution of the American Cemetery. Kenneth Jackson wrote the text. He's the author of a previous book on the suburbanization of America. Camilo Jose Vergara took the photos. He spent the past decade documenting American slums. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kenneth Jackson and Camilo Vergara, co-authors of Silent Cities, The Evolution of the American Cemetery.
Camilo, earlier in our conversation, you were talking about how you had documented decaying urban areas, and you'd have to often walk through or walk around these really beautiful, wealthy cemeteries.
That's right.
Have you also documented decaying cemeteries that have been abandoned or have been allowed to go to seed?
Well, first of all, that's something that is much more common in England than it is in the United States. In the United States, there's still interest, and the cemeteries are by and large still well cared, so that exceptionally you do see a cemetery and that it's having problems. But oftentimes that has to do with this, with the place, the placement of a cemetery. For instance, it's deadly to have a cemetery next to a high school because that means that the high school students are going to be crossing through it or passing through it, and it's going to be incorporated into any prank or any free time that they have. I remember a cemetery in Queens where one typical thing that students would do would be to topple angels. They would actually throw a rope over an angel and then pull it, and the angel would come crashing down. And then there were a number of monuments that all the cemetery could do, because it didn't have the funds to fix them, was to pile them up. And as you look around, you saw these hills full of cemeteries with thousands of names, full of tombstones, I'm sorry. And those were quite striking. Now, cemeteries have ended in some other ways. You know, some of them have been on the paths of expressways. Some of them have been in place of facilities that have been built, so that, and some of them have been in place of urban development, so that they have been moved elsewhere. And those cemeteries are lost because all you can see there is what has been put there new.
Do you each own plots in cemeteries for your future?
No, I don't.
I do, but that's a fairly unusual circumstance. Most I think I'm one of the few people who does own a plot.
Kenneth, I'm wondering if you ever visit the graves of relatives.
Well, I do, Terry. It's because I had a 16-year-old son who was killed in an automobile crash 6 years ago. And that, of course, has changed my circumstance. Incidentally, I was already working on the cemetery project before my son's death.
Right.
But that does take me back to the cemetery. I do return to it, not with great frequency, but certainly at least every month or so. And I do find that when I go there, sometimes I do not want to go there because to go there is to know that you're going to become sad. I do think that that's one of the reasons we don't like to go to cemeteries, is because it really does make us come to grips with something that's very painful to us. And that's why I realize that sometimes when I'm driving and when I drive into the cemetery, I turn off the radio, because somehow it seems that it's not right to be concerned with the latest news or the latest ball scores or something else if you're even approaching the grave of someone you love, which, by the way, is why I bought the plot, is when a tragedy like that happens, they'll only sell two at a time. So if you lose a child, you want very much to be buried beside that child. And otherwise, I'm sure I would not have prepared for that either. So that's why I'm a serious cemetery grave lot owner.
You could tell me if this is too personal, but when you visit your son's grave, do you feel like it's something you're doing more for you or more for him?
That's a tough one. I suppose maybe if I were to be honest with myself, it's more for him. I sort of feel like it's a way of telling him he's not forgotten. And the parent, I think, naturally feels, you feel guilty if you survive your children. And that the very fact of survival, it's almost like being a Holocaust survivor. It shouldn't have happened to you somehow. And you sort of want to go back, I guess for both of you. I don't know that I could separate those two out. But you sort of do feel, at least I feel, that I have to go back once in a while, even though every time I go, it hurts me.
Yeah. Well, let me say I'm sorry to hear about your son.
Yeah. If I could add something to that.
Yeah.
It just sounded very... it seemed to me that in the cemetery, in the first period, and I mean, let's say if 1940 or 1950 was a big watershed when attitudes changed, before that period, the that kind of separation and the question that you just asked, Ken, it seemed to me would have been less on our minds than today. That was the great strength of the cemetery, was the fact that you could merge, is that your son was part of you. So you were your son and your son was you. So were your parents. And that the cemetery and to be with them, with all your ancestors in one place, or even within one cemetery, within different plots, offer you a possibility to place yourself in the past and to place yourself in the future. It offered you, it sounds like an amazing thing, but it did give you broad horizons.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.
It was a pleasure, Terry.
My guests have been Kenneth Jackson and Camilo Jose Vergara. Their book about American cemeteries is called Silent Cities. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Billie Whitelaw went to London in the 50s, her working-class accent was considered inappropriate for a proper actress. But she became one of the actresses who broadened the scope of British theater. Coming up, Whitelaw talks with us about the British theater, her collaborations with Samuel Beckett, and her starring role in the film The Craze, which just came out on home video. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg compares some languages to endangered species. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Over the past 24 hours, there have been a series of violent incidents in northern Iraq. More than a dozen Kurds and at least two Iraqis have been killed, and U.S. military officials say the situation in and around the Allied security zone is growing worse. NPR's Neil Conan reports from the Turkish-Iraqi border.
U.S. officers confirmed today that 10 Kurds were killed by Iraqi troops yesterday in Erbil, a city outside the security zone, although exactly how is still unclear. In Dohuk, the provincial capital outside the zone where 50 U.N. guards provide symbolic security, Kurdish demonstrators attacked the Iraqi police station and stormed the ruling Ba'ath Party headquarters. Both sides used heavy weapons in that attack, including mortars and rocket-propelled grenades. Several Kurds and two Ba'ath Party officials were killed in Dohuk. The Ba'ath headquarters was torched, and a dozen cars were burned there. Iraqi police fled the city, and today, Peshmerga guerrillas control the police station and patrol the streets in brand-new Iraqi police cars, Oldsmobile Sierras. The commander of USMPs in Iraq, Colonel Ed Delt, said that the Kurds, now that they're no longer starving, are beginning to take their revenge. And that, he said, was a development that concerned him. This is Neil Conan reporting.
In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has given the green light for the Bush administration's policy of giving third world countries money for family planning programs, only if those programs do not perform abortions or discuss abortion. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The High Court, without comment, refused to review a lower court decision that left the anti-abortion policy intact. The court's action was widely expected after its decision 2 weeks ago upholding a similar program here in the United States. At issue in today's case was a policy adopted by the Reagan administration in 1984, under which family planning clinics in foreign countries would be ineligible for U.S. foreign aid funds if those clinics either performed abortions or discussed abortion with patients or in training personnel. The U.S. gave $227 million to population planning clinics abroad last year. That's about 40% of all family planning money provided by developed countries to poor nations. And at each clinic that got U.S. money, abortion was a forbidden topic of discussion. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
And by a vote of 6-3, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that attorneys in non-criminal trials may not bar people from serving on juries solely because of race. This ruling follows one in 1986 when race-based exclusions of jurors on criminal trials was barred. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 8 points to close at a record high of 3,035.33 on volume of some 174 million shares. This is NPR News. In Lithuania, there are reports of Soviet troop movement at various points around the capital of Vilnius, including the airport and outside of parliament. According to these reports, several thousand Lithuanian citizens also gathered in the square outside of parliament. Government officials have been unable to get through to military officials in Moscow for an explanation of what is occurring. Earlier today in Moscow, the Soviet prosecutor's office denied that civilians were killed by Soviet forces when troops stormed a television station in Lithuania earlier this year. This account is in conflict with reports by Western correspondents in the crowd as soldiers opened fire. Pictures taken at the time also showed one protester being crushed by a tank. In the Middle East, Israeli Prime Minister Shamir has criticized Egyptian President Mubarak, saying that he is not doing enough to move the peace process forward. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Shamir was speaking at the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee.
He said that Egypt is not helping the peace process and that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak consistently criticized Israel in general and Shamir himself in particular. Shamir's sharp words about Mubarak were surprising because Egypt has been very supportive of the peace process. Shamir also confirmed that he had received a letter from President Bush about the peace process. Shamir said the letter did not include an invitation to a summit meeting with Syrian President Assad in Washington. He would not say what the letter did contain, but Israeli press reports said Bush sent a personal appeal to several Middle East leaders, including President Assad and King Hussein of Jordan. Shamir was reportedly asked to agree to let the UN play a role at a regional peace conference. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In Albania, thousands of workers demonstrated in support of some 100 miners fasting for almost 2 weeks. They are pressing anti-government demands. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Gangster movies often give us the chance to see offbeat performances by great character actors. But it's usually male character actors who star in the films. More often than not, the leading actress is the beautiful Moll. But in the film The Craze, you can see the British actress Billy Whitelaw give a compelling performance as Violet Cray, the devoted mother of twin gangsters. The movie is based on the true story of Ronnie and Reggie Cray, who ruled London's underworld in the 60s and are currently serving life sentences in England. It just came out on video. Billy Whitelaw is a prominent British actress who isn't as well known in America as she is at home. She's received awards for her work in theater, television, and film. She had a close working relationship with the late playwright Samuel Beckett, who wrote several plays for her. American audiences probably know her best for her roles in The Omen and The Dressmaker. American actresses, especially character actresses, find that there are very few good roles available for them. I asked Billy Whitelaw if she faced a similar problem in England.
Yes, I mean, I have been very lucky. I have played some marvellous roles in my time, but you're right, and it's exactly the same here. There seem to be far more exciting roles for actors than there are for actresses, I think by a ratio of 10 to 1. Why that is, I don't know. Perhaps it's because most of the writers are male. But you're absolutely right, and it is the same here. Most of the interesting leading roles in theatre and in film are male, but that goes right back to Shakespeare's time, doesn't it?
What's your interpretation of the mother in this story, of a mother who is very devoted to her two sons, and they're both gangsters?
Yes, I could only, the only way I could sort of get to terms with that half of Violet is to elect, as Billy Whitelaw, the actress playing Violet, I elected not to see that side of my sons, of the boys. I know it is possible, and God knows medical case histories are full of things like this, where you can elect not to be aware of something if what is staring you in the face is just too terrible for you to absorb. And I think she so loved these boys, I think she elected not to take that on board, not to absorb it.
Did you visit the Cray twins in their prisons?
No, I didn't. Reggie you can't visit because he actually is in a high security prison. Ronnie is in a psychiatric hospital, and he can have visitors. Ronnie said I would be more than welcome to go down and see him, but I professionally elected not to because I didn't want to get the real life Ronald Cray confused with my theatrical Ronnie Cray. Do you know what I mean? I had in my mind and actually in my working day an experience of the two boys, Gary and Martin, who were playing my sons. And I felt, had I gone to see Ronnie, it would have become confusing. I'd have been putting Ronnie in Gary's place instead of acting with Gary.
You age around 30 years in the movie, and you age in increments. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a sudden shift from one period to another. What was done for your makeup? Did you watch it getting put on? And I wonder what the experience was like of seeing yourself gradually age over 30 years.
Well, it actually doesn't happen gradually when you're sitting in front of the makeup. I've had it done before. It's not very nice. They actually stretch the skin on your face in between a finger and thumb and stretch it and then paint a rubber solution on it and hold it until it dries. And just before it dries, it's a bit like putting what we call household adhesive on your face just before it dries. Then they squash your face up a bit like a prune. And it all sticks, and it's very horrible when it goes around the eyes. In fact, I requested that they didn't put too much around the eyes, that I was somewhat flattered that they thought I needed quite so much.
One of the things I like most about your performance in The Craze was your voice, the way you spoke. And I thought that there was something very musical about the way you spoke. And I'm wondering if when
really?
You... Yeah, I'm wondering if when you get a part, you almost see it as a score.
Well, I think if I'm doing an accent, I think all accents are musical. In The Craze, I don't use the same accent as I'm using now. I don't know whether you can tell the difference. I'll do a bit for you in Cockney. In The Craze, I talk like that, you know, and she's a Cockney. She comes from the East End, and she talks like that. Well, I don't talk like that. And whenever I do an accent, which I do very often, I think each accent has its own music, and I never worry about saying the actual words correctly. I think if I get the music of the accent right, then people will believe that I come from that part of the world. So in that sense, yes, you're right, Terry, in that sense, yes, I do tackle things musically.
Actress Billie Whitelaw is my guest. She stars in the movie The Craze, which just came out on video. We'll talk about her work with Samuel Beckett after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress Billie Whitelaw is my guest. You worked very closely with Beckett. He wrote some of his mm-hmm. pieces for you. What was the collaboration process like when you were actually working on one of his plays?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery, really. I know, first of all, we just got on well. I feel that I was just part of his ongoing process of creating a role. I just put myself totally in his hands and bent over backwards to try and do and achieve what it was he wanted me to do, and to sound and create the music that I thought he wanted. And we didn't intellectualize, we didn't analyze, we didn't dissect the plays and the dialogue. We went for the music, and I felt in my gut that if the music of the piece was right, it would work for him.
When you say that you worked almost musically, what does that mean?
We would just conduct each other. We would say, let's say, Happy Days or Not I, which is a sort of raging, rambling monologue of a vocal vomit, I call it. We would just sit and talk to each other and just recite the lines over and over and over and over again. And I would, whenever I went to the bathroom, whenever I went to the shower, I drove my family mad. I was just repeating this stuff over and over and over again. And if I would bump into Beckett in a corridor, or I would break into it and he would join me. In fact, both of us, every photograph, practically every photograph he and I have had taken together, we're both of us conducting each other.
Did you sometimes feel that you almost had to rely on the music of the speech because the actual meaning of the speech was obscure?
I never worried about the meaning. I know it sounds dreadful, but I didn't, and Sam knew this. I felt what it meant intellectually. I didn't care what it meant. It's very arrogant of me to say that, but it's true. And he didn't seem to mind. I never knew what they meant intellectually, but I can feel what they meant. They're all about the story of my life, most of them. Me as Mrs. Everywoman, not me as Billie Whitelaw, because he's writing about Billie Whitelaw in particular. I recognized the condition, and that's what I wanted to come out of my mouth, and that was the battle.
When you started your acting career, I think you became known as one of the new working-class actors who were coming along, and you made several of the realist working-class films that became known as the kitchen sink style. Why was it such a departure to be a working-class actress?
Well, we didn't have the theatrical tradition that you have in America, where you have sort of the group theatre and Clifford Odets and writers like that. We had a different tradition here of the classical theatre, and our popular boulevard theatre were people like Noel Coward and John Gielgud and writers like Terence Rattigan. And I'm now going to do what, as a child, when I heard proper actors and actresses, which I didn't think I was, they seemed to speak something like this. Their voices were sort of rather what we call here South Kensington. Now, I didn't speak like that at all. I came from a part of England where there... Could you tell the difference in my voice there?
Yes, I could.
Or not?
Yeah,
you could.
Definitely.
Well, that's how proper actors and actresses spoke. And until we lot from the north of England, most of us invaded London. Unless you spoke like that, you weren't employed, unless you were employed as an actor playing funny little common secretaries or funny little waitresses or the leading lady's funny little friend.
Were you afraid that you wouldn't ever be able to break in because you were not proper in your speech?
Well, no. I mean, I had an inferiority complex, which was as tall as the Empire State Building, because I came from a North Country working-class family. But when I came down to London, which is the time that a whole lot of people came down and things changed, Joan Littlewood was changing the face of the theatre here, and Albert Finney was breaking moulds here. And we all seemed to arrive at the same time. And I suddenly found the way I spoke, which was a broader than I'm speaking now, I had a North Country accent, was fashionable.
Did you ever end up doing Shakespeare in the classics?
I did, and for someone who came from where I came from, I ended up playing Desdemona opposite to Laurence Olivier at the National Theatre, so that was quite a jump for me.
Did you feel that you had to do a different kind of accent to do Shakespeare?
Martita Hunt, who is a marvellous, marvellous actress. I remember her saying to me once, "My darling girl, are you aware that when you go on the stage sometimes, you put on a funny voice? You don't need to, you know." And I took cognizance of that. Yes, I was putting on a funny voice, you're right, Terry, but I don't think I did, eventually. I don't think I do now. I mean, the way I'm speaking now is me. It's me. It's a bit... It's the edges are around it, but... that is my own natural voice.
The two recent movies that I've seen you in, The Craze and The Dressmaker, are both set during World War II in England. They're both about women keeping families together without adult men, without fathers or husbands around, or at least not around very much, not around much to like really matter a lot. Both of these movies are in a lot of ways about the ties between women. What was your war experience like?
Horrible. I was what's laughingly called a war baby. Now, I was in Coventry during the war. I'd be six, and actually they've just celebrated now 50 years of the dreadful blitz of Coventry, 3 days, which I remember as though it were yesterday, when Coventry was annihilated. It was bombarded. I can still hear it in my head. Yes, I was bombed during the war. And my father was still at home because he was hard of hearing, he was deaf. But there weren't very many men around. They were all away fighting.
What was the effect of the war on your family?
It is something that I always get a bit astonished when people say, "Oh, they were marvellous days and the great camaraderie." I thought it was awful. It made me a great pacifist. I thought people really shouldn't do this to each other, you know. My sister was injured in the bombing, and I didn't like seeing people being wounded. I didn't like being frightened night after night with all this stuff dropping out of the skies. And it does get me a bit angry when I hear people flippantly say, oh, go and drop bombs on them or nuke them or whatever, you know. It's not very pleasant when you're on the other end of it, you know. But it was something that we all had to go through here, and a lot of people have been through a lot worse. But not nice.
After having worked with Samuel Beckett for so long, do you feel that there's things that you used to do with him that you now apply to the way you interpret roles in movies?
Yes, actually, my husband says to me, will you stop tackling every role as though you were doing a one-woman Beckett monstrosity? By that, I mean a sort of a mountain of a role. I'm apt to bring a sledgehammer sometimes to a role when it doesn't really need it. And I've got to stop doing that. I really have got to stop doing that. That's only my own anxiety. I'm so used to girding my loins to tackle a very difficult role that sometimes I will have to say, I say to myself, well, it doesn't need all this energy from me to do this. I can just relax, and it's not as hard as I think it is. With Beckett, it was as hard as I thought it was.
Maybe that's what comes through in the role that makes your performances so special.
Well, it's not from lack of doing my homework, I must say. It's made me, I sort of lock myself away in a room and work like a demon when I'm asked to do a role. I mean, far more than is very often necessary, but perhaps I'll get over that, I hope.
Billy Whitelaw stars in the film The Craze, which has just been released on video. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered. Coming up later on today's program, we'll hear from Mara Liasson on Capitol Hill about the jockeying going on over the civil rights bill and what the differences are between the administration's version of a civil rights bill and the bill that Democrats favor. Also, a report on the panic in northern Iraq. It's expected that U.S. forces will be pulling out of the region soon, and the minority groups there, including the Kurds, are fearful of what Iraq may do once the U.S. leaves. And there are reports already of Iraqi tanks appearing in the city of Sulaymaniyah. Also, a talk with the Nicholas Brothers, some terrific tap dancers. That's coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
One of the striking features of the Academy Award-winning movie Dances with Wolves was the use of the Lakota language, which is spoken by the Sioux people. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says Lakota is more fortunate than many other languages.
Lakota is one of the few Native American languages that still have a fair number of speakers left. That may be because the Sioux are one of the largest Indian nations, whose communities are relatively self-contained. But the majority of the Native American languages spoken when the Europeans first arrived have already become extinct, and only a few are likely to survive into the next century. This is not just an American problem. All over the world, languages are dying out at a rate that makes the disappearance of biological species pale by comparison. For example, there are about 4,500 mammal species in the world, of which about 7.5% are endangered or threatened. By contrast, there are perhaps 6,000 human languages. And at the best estimate, roughly half of these are already doomed, in the sense that no children speak them anymore, only adults. They're like species whose members are all past breeding age. Another 45% of the world's languages are endangered or threatened, with rapidly declining numbers of speakers. That leaves just 5%, around 300 languages, that can be counted as safe. Part of this attrition is simply a result of the features of modern life that naturally draw people into wider communities, population movements, mass education, and the media. But a lot of languages have been actively suppressed. The English tried for centuries to eradicate all of the Celtic languages in the British Isles, and they were very nearly successful. Cornish and Manx are gone, and Welsh, Irish, and Scots Gaelic are hanging on by a thread. In this country, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began in the 1870s to force Indian children to go to boarding schools where they were often beaten for speaking their native languages. That system wasn't fully abandoned until after the Second World War. And policies like these are still in effect in many other nations. The Turks may have grudgingly allowed some Kurdish refugees to cross their border from Iraq, but it's still against the law in Turkey to speak Kurdish in public. Well, but why should anybody bother about the fate of Kickapoo and Paiute, or Welsh and Breton? It's obvious nobody can get by in the modern world without speaking a major language. But for many peoples, an ancestral language provides a sense of culture and community that an impersonal international language can't provide. In a few places, there are programs and organizations trying to give endangered languages a second lease on life, and these have recently gotten congressional support. There's some hope for Wallapai, Mohawk, and Inuit, and for some of the endangered languages of Australia and Europe. Still, most languages are already beyond saving. Within 100 years, almost all of the traditional cultures of the world will have become completely mute. I got a sense of what this is like from talking to the linguist Susan Steele, who works on Luiseno. That's a Southern California Indian language related to Hopi and Shoshone. There are only a handful of Luiseno speakers left, all of them old women. When the last male speaker died a few years ago, there was no one left to sing the songs that Luiseno men traditionally chant at funerals. You wonder what it's like to be the last speaker of a language, your head sounding with ghostly voices that only you can hear.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, and Thad Kirk. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What does it mean when your tuna fish can says, "Dolphin safe"? And how is that connected to free trade talks? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with environmental activist Sam Labuddy and environmental lawyer Josh Flom. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.